Welcome to the History of California podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. Today we have Rob Crissell on the show. Rob is an author, poet, actor, winemaker, and teacher in Temecula, California. For the past 8 years, he's taught poetry and Shakespeare with the Murrieta Valley Union School District. He has written and regularly performed several one-man plays featuring Romeo and Juliet, Hamlet, and Shakespeare in America. He's also the author of a children's novel, The Zoo of Impossible Animals, as well as Shakespeare's Book of Wisdom, Advice on Living a Wiser, Happier Life from William Shakespeare and Friends, and The Fantastic Fables of Aesop. He's also written history books, including two that we will discuss in today's conversation, Temecula Valley Wineries, and our focus today, California Avocados, A Delicious History. I love talking to people like Rob, people with many interests, many areas of expertise, because, like Rob, I'm a generalist. I love exploring a lot of different subjects to find out where they intersect. If you like those kinds of conversations, you will love this one. Let's go meet Rob Crissell. Rob, you've written about a lot of different topics and subjects. I'm curious, when you begin a new topic, like avocados, for example, can you talk us through what your typical writing and research process looks like?
First, I try to figure out what has been done, obviously, on the subject matter before and in preparation for the proposal to the publisher. But post-proposal, when I start really researching, I just try to get an idea of kind of what is going to be the scope of the work. Come up with a rough outline, obviously, but also just what are my resources? And to gauge how long this is going to take me, how much time I want to spend on research, because research can go on forever if you let it, but at some point you got to cut it off. And it's nice when there's a closed universe, as there was for my wine book that I did on Temecula. It was a very closed universe. Not too much has been written about Temecula wine. And there were only 47 wineries and a limited number of personalities. So I knew what I was up against. But with avocados, the industry started in 1915. Avocados have been around in California since 1850. And it turned out there was quite a lot written on it, but not a single book. And so what I like to do is just gather everything together, read the books I have to read, and then I start the interview process. And I interviewed 35 people for this book. And avocados are an equal opportunity thing. So you don't just have the academics. You've got people who are very passionate about it and know far more in some cases than any academic because they're a farmer or they're a seller or whatever. And they've been in the avocado business for 40 years, whatever it is. So I looked around at what had been written and picked out about four people that I absolutely had to start with. And luckily, I'm from Fallbrook, California, the so-called avocado capital of the world. And so I had inadvertently been around these people in my youth. So I called them up and many of them were retired and started with them. And my circle of contacts got bigger and bigger because when you're writing about a subject that there, every subject has some controversy if you dig deep enough. And the avocado industry has different camps that are sometimes opposed. And there's been controversy off and on since 1915. And so I, as an outsider, didn't want, and so I was very careful with who I started with and who I spread my circle of contacts, because I knew eventually I was going to run into people who hated each other. And I wanted to make sure they knew, I don't care. I don't care about your grievances. I want to present the true story from the beginning, and you're a part of it, and that person's a part of it. So I'm going to treat you all fairly. So I guess that's how I did. I built outward and just built that pyramid, you know?
Yeah. You've done a lot of different things. So many of them fascinated me. I really enjoyed your TED talk about Shakespeare.
Oh, thank you.
Do you think if I set two unnamed plays in front of you, one by Christopher Marlowe or Ben Jonson, and then one by Shakespeare, do you think you'd be able to tell the difference?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, no, definitely. First, I would probably know the Marlowe play, and I know the Shakespeare play.
Well, if they were unnamed, if they were anonymous lost plays, if you will.
Yes. The short answer is probably. The longer answer is Marlowe was before Shakespeare. Marlowe influenced Shakespeare. much shorter career and has a certain older style. And Shakespeare's older works, like Richard III or even Romeo and Juliet, but Titus Andronicus, his early stuff, Henry VI trilogy, those sound like Marlowe. But once you get into his Shakespeare's classical period, sounds like Shakespeare, Webster, or Fletcher, or Ben Jonson, or Dryden. Nobody sounds like Shakespeare. And so for me, having lived and breathed Shakespeare, acted, taught since forever, it'd be easy. I'd like to say it would be easy for me to know the difference. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. What do you think is the most overrated Shakespeare play and the most underrated Shakespeare play?
Oh, yeah, I love that you're talking about Shakespeare. Okay. In fact, I was just teaching Shakespeare at an assisted living here in Murrieta. And I do a bunch of speeches and then I get them to do it. But I'll start with the most overrated. So the most overrated has to be Midsummer Night's Dream. It's a nice money maker. It's a family play. It's funny. It's light. And it gets performed to death. Every year there's 24 professional Midsummer Night Dreams going on across the United States. But it is enjoyable, but I get tired of the farce. I get tired of the Three's Company is what it is. And for Shakespeare, that's extremely overrated. Some might argue that Romeo and Juliet is overrated. It gets performed a lot, but that is a gift that keeps on giving for me. When I was teaching Shakespeare in high school levels, you teach a junior or sophomore, you know this, and they're all jaded and they think Romeo and Juliet, to the extent they know Romeo and Juliet, they're a bunch of idiots and they think it's dumb. By the time they really get done with it, they love it because you get a comedy, you get a tragedy, you get people trying to do their best and having bad results happen. You get parents not understanding kids and kids doing stupid kid things. It's a very relatable, but very deep and almost mystical play. Love that one. But the most underrated play, I think, is Winter's Tale. And Winter's Tale doesn't get performed too often, but it's one of Shakespeare's final works. And he probably wrote it 2 or 3 years before he retired from the stage. It's they call it a romance. So there's a lot of tragedy in there. It's part Othello at the beginning, where a king has an unreasonable jealousy of his wonderful queen wife, accuses her of adultery with his best friend. None of that is factual at all. None of it's true. And yet he gets it into his mind that it is. And in fact, he thinks his daughter, his one-year-old daughter, born of Hermione, is a bastard child. He orders the child killed. Luckily, his loyal servant doesn't do it. She grows up in a parallel kingdom. His son, though, dies. So you have this kind of light romance comedy, and his son dies because his mom is taken away from him. He gets sick and he dies. And so the king realizes he's made a horrible mistake. He spends the rest of his life regretting it. Thank God, or thank the mystical nature of the universe, his daughter is raised up. His daughter ends up marrying his best friend's daughter. She comes back to him. And lo and behold, his wife, who he thought had died, was actually kept away and is resurrected, as it were, at the end. And so everything is the same at the end, but everything's different. And I think Shakespeare, at the end of his life, was done with comedies and tragedies, and he was seeing this weird paradoxical nature of life. His son had died, Shakespeare's son had died. By then, he was seeing friends pass away around him. He was beginning the end of his life, probably had a terminal disease himself, and he becomes a mystic at the end. So Winter's Tale, if it's out there, you got to go see it. So, have you seen it?
Yes, I love Winter's Tale. Now, before we talk about avocados, I do want to mention I enjoyed your book on Temecula wines as well.
Oh, good.
And I'm curious, as someone that has lived in wine country before, I lived in Lodi for a year and got to experience the big, juicy, jammy Zins. For you, what do you think really makes, if you had to summarize it succinctly, what makes Temecula wine distinct within the California universe of wine? And then do you think Temecula's importance as a wine region is going to grow or decrease in the next 20 years?
That's a good question. I'm making a Zinfandel right now.
Oh, really? Okay, fantastic.
It's, by its Italian name, it's called Primitivo.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Primitivo and Zinfandel are the same, but it's a different style. So I've got that in barrel right now. But I've been here since 03, and so I've watched the wine country really evolve from, say, 20 wineries now to 47. And it's changed mostly for the good. We've gotten much better wines, especially in the last 10 years, as new owners come in, new winemakers, people throwing more money. It's not that the old timers weren't good, but they lacked some resources. They lacked cutting edge stuff. And so they had some good things about them and bad things. Now, most of those old timers are gone and you've got some real professional wineries. But so to answer your question, what Temecula brings, because Temecula is held in great disdain by even people in Lodi probably, but certainly yeah. people in Napa or Paso, is that we had a blank slate. Almost all our vines were wiped out in the late 90s by the Pierce's disease. And so we had a chance to replant. And so instead of replanting Chardonnay, which was practically the only thing planted here for 30 years, Chardonnay and Cab and Merlot, we started planting grapes that were more appropriate to our very hot region, which tended to be Italian varietals like Sangiovese and Montepulciano and Vermentino, and Spanish varietals. So the Rioja blend varietals like Tempranillo, and then a lot of hot Rhone varietals. So a lot of Grenache and Syrah in particular. And these grapes really express themselves well here. You go up to Napa, you don't want to try Sangiovese in Napa. You won't even find hardly. And a Syrah, you'll find Syrahs, but not very many. That land is perfect for Cabernet and the Bordeaux varietals. And in Sonoma, it's perfect for Chardonnay and Pinot Noir. But down here, we produce this wonderful off-brand Spanish, Italian, Southern Rhone varietals. And so if you come here and you want to get a great Sauvignon Blanc or a great Cabernet Sauvignon, you're not going to find it, in my opinion. You're not going to find great examples of that. But if you're willing to think outside the box and try an Albarino or try a Sangiovese or a Montepulciano, you're going to be really pleasantly surprised. So I guess that is the big advantage. I bet there are more varietals grown in Temecula than anywhere else in the whole world. I should say the more variety of varietals. In other words, there are some wineries here that have 25 different wines at a winery. If you go to Napa, they focus. There are two or three or four wines. Maybe the big ones will have 10. It's not unusual for us to have 25 different varietals, not just blends, but different varietals altogether. And I think that makes us pretty unique. We're still figuring it out. And to answer your second part of your question, we are going to get better as the experimentation period, which I think we're toward the end of, hardens into, okay, these varieties really go well here. These do not. These are popular. These Roussanne is not popular. Viognier, it's jury's out, probably not popular. And so we're going to focus on five or six varietals, I think, that are going to put us on the map. But right now, we're just a great, fun place to go that is an hour and a half from 30 million people. And that's what makes us unique, is that people from LA and San Diego can come here within an hour and a half and have a great time and go back home. You can't say that about Napa and Paso.
Yeah, it's a great day trip location.
Yeah.
Last question before we get to guacamole. I'm a librarian, and so I'm very familiar with the space known as middle grade fiction, which unfortunately, middle grade fiction, there's a dearth of high quality middle grade fiction. There's a lot of emphasis on children's books and a lot of emphasis on YA. Why do you think middle grade fiction has a problem producing consistently good books?
Well, that's a good question. I should send you my book that I wrote called The Zoo of Impossible Animals. That was
right. I have it.
Oh, you do? Oh,
yes.
Okay. Oh, wonderful. So that's middle grade-ish, although you could say it's tweens. But I have taught a lot of middle grade. And I think the problem might be that you're at that point where teachers maybe want to start giving adult fiction and grown-up fiction, and so that YA stuff comes into play. So there, it's too late for them to read, I guess, The Wind in the Willows or Where the Red Fern Grows, but it's too early for them to read War and Peace and, I don't know, Huckleberry Finn. And so they get this everything thrown at them. But I'm not as involved in it anymore like I used to be. I used to present my book to fifth and sixth and seventh grade, and I'm just not sure why that might be. What is your theory?
Yeah, it's similar to yours that it's a weird inflection point, and kids are transitioning through that middle grade fiction at different speeds. And so it feels like a child development question more than anything. And then it seems like for authors, given that kind of it's a weird inflection point, there's a higher risk in terms of writing in that domain. That's what I would assume, but that's just speculation.
I think a lot of advanced kids, I was this way, and probably you were, are reading adult books. They're getting adult books handed to them. I read The Fountainhead in eighth grade, and
Wow.
I was really into Asimov and Bradbury and books that were an earlier generation's idea of kids' books or young adult or teen books, but certainly were not now. And so I skipped over whatever was being offered to a typical sixth, seventh, eighth grader at my time. And I think that's often what happens. The advanced readers are reading adult books, and the people who are a little slower on the uptake, or a little don't like reading as much, are still stuck at YA or younger books. I don't
Yeah.
know.
Yeah. Let's talk about avocados now. What do you think is distinctive about writing a biography of a fruit?
That's a good question. I think that in my case, it's very personal because I was from Fallbrook, California. I moved there from San Clemente when I was 11 years old. I lived there all through school and left at the end of high school to go to college. But my parents are still there, many of my friends. And so I had this awareness right away that a fruit is not just the pulp and the skin and the seed and and all the scientific aspects of it. It's passion, it's people, it's culture. And growing up in Fallbrook, the avocado was always around. Even if you didn't like it, there were parades and avocado princesses and packing houses on Main Street. And you walked to school through these ancient groves and you heard the avocados falling and you threw them against the tree or at your brother. And so for me, writing this biography of a fruit was really writing about all the people who have fallen in love with the fruit and made that fruit the most important part of their life. I didn't do that, but I realized that there was a whole industry of people that devoted their whole lives to this avocado. And part of my goal in the book was to figure out why they did that.
Let's start with some origins. So I think we all have a general sense that avocados come from Mexico or southern, or more southern along Central America. What's the early kind of quote prehistoric evidence that we have of avocados' existence?
It's obviously in my book in the sort of Avocados Before California chapter, but I guess we have some very early evidence of prehistoric and archaeological evidence of avocado pits in Middens, for example, from 7,000 BC, 8,000 BC in places like Guatemala, Mexico, but even as far south as Peru, among very ancient peoples, the peoples who preceded the Olmecs, let alone the Mayans and the Aztecs, that they were using avocados. They're naming their cities after avocados. They're using avocados as part of the barter and trade. And so that shows up in, again, the archaeological evidence, but also later on in the early Spanish who are recording some of those Incans, for example, who were talking about avocados back 200, 300 years ago. But we know from Middens, and we know from the general spread of the avocado tree around Central America and Mexico that it had been utilized by humans for thousands of years, because it wouldn't have spread the way it did. It wouldn't have been grouped around cities and places unless it had been not only utilized to a great extent, but domesticated as well. So it was probably domesticated by 900, 800 BC. So it was used extensively since the 8th century BC. But we know, humans being what they are and having been, they're down there probably for 10,000 years, they were eating those just like the giant sloths were eating them, just like other big fauna were eating these avocados, because the wonderful thing about avocados, they're high in fat. And when people are always starving, as they were in ancient times, you need all the fat and oil you can get. And so it was a great substitute for meat, I'm sure, when they couldn't hunt.
What does it tell us about the Spanish view of avocados that they never made their way to the mission system?
Yeah. I wrote this book on the wineries, and I did some historical research on the origin of not just grapes, but all fruits and vegetables that came from Spain or came from Mexico and were brought up by those missionaries. And the avocado was conspicuously absent. And it's a mystery why that is. But one theory, and maybe it's my own theory, but I think it's valid, is that the avocado had this reputation for being an aphrodisiac. The Spanish mention it, and they mention how these Mayans and Aztecs would run wild during harvest, and they'd have to hide the virgins inside the huts or inside their houses so they wouldn't get ravaged by all these horny avocado pickers during, we're talking about 1300, 1400, 1500 AD. And then the Spanish attributed it. And then when the English came along and found avocados, they said, it's no wonder the Spanish love this fruit, because it's an aphrodisiac. It's just, they're sex maniacs anyway, the Spanish. So every culture that found it was jingoistically insulting the other. I think they just love the greasiness and just how rich and indulgent an avocado can be. So maybe that's why those friars, who were a little bit nervous about these naked Native Americans that they were proselytizing to, they were like, okay, we'll bring up oranges and we'll bring up tomatoes and chocolate that we got, and coffee even, and alcohol. But avocados, no, we're not touching avocados. They're too dangerous. We can't let these people run wild with lust. So that might be one theory. Yeah.
Have you peddled this to any academics?
No, because I want to keep this theory to myself. No, the other, probably more.
It's such a great theory. I would be peddling it everywhere.
I looked for backup on it, and nobody seems to either know or care, but I care. And so we do know for sure that probably the Spaniards in the 1800s, they were bringing avocados up. We see these rogue avocado trees up in Berkeley and places where the Spanish, or rather the Mexicans, had landed in that in-between time, certainly after the missions were confiscated by the Californios, but before California took over, they eventually brought avocados up. The other theory is that a lot of these missionaries, like Junipero Serra and Lawson, who founded San Luis Rey, were aware that avocados required a lot of water. And they knew that they were going to a very dry climate in Arizona and New Mexico and California. And they figured this is not this tropical, because that's what avocados are. They're a semi-tropical fruit, is not going to grow in a California climate. And for the most part, they're correct, because avocados only grow in a very thin slice of California, let alone the United States of America. They really only grow in San Diego County, Orange County, LA County, Santa Barbara and Ventura and San Luis Obispo. It's very difficult to plant them elsewhere. So maybe they just thought, oh, it's not worth it. We're not going to trouble ourselves with that. I don't know.
Okay. Let's talk about how they eventually did arrive in California. Why did it take so long? I think I would imagine all the rancherias that were up and down the coast of California, one of those ranchers would have wanted avocados. But why did it take the United States invading Alta California and that period? Why did it take so long?
Well, I think I trace it to just the slow transition of fruit, all sorts of fruit coming up through the Americas, through the Caribbean islands, and then eventually Florida. I think one of the main reasons it took so long is that it took so long to conquer, I guess you could say, or colonize California. California, they thought California was an island. The Spanish did, and most of the world thought we were an island forever. And it's because we were so inaccessible. And so it took forever for the Spanish to even get here. They were colonized, conquered Mexico in the 1500s. They didn't get to California until the late 1700s. So it took forever to get here. And the avocado went the back way. It went from Cuba to Florida because Florida was just closer to those Caribbean islands. And so they started planting avocado trees. Probably the Native Americans planted the avocado trees in Florida. And so once those avocado trees started bearing fruit, literally, all of a sudden people thought California has better weather than Florida. Maybe we should bring this fruit, as we did with oranges, maybe we should bring this fruit to California and see what it does there. By the way, one of the first Americans, and I point out in my book to write about enjoying an avocado, was George Washington himself. When he went to, with his cousin had tuberculosis, like so many people did, and he needed to rehabilitate. I think it was in, I can't remember where it is, but one of the islands, it was maybe Jamaica. And Washington talks about this amazing Spanish pear that he's eating and how addicted he was to the Spanish pear. And yet it couldn't follow him back because it's just too cold and not warm enough for those avocados to grow anywhere north of Florida, certainly. So eventually it does come to California, but not until probably the mid 1800s. So once America discovers California with the gold rush, then there's a reason finally for them to start exploiting the land and start growing everything they possibly can. And that meant avocados, finally.
Yeah. You trace very carefully the process of kind of the word of mouth distribution of the knowledge of the avocado. Even though we don't know who the first, the first grower in California, we can get a sense of how this process goes. Can you talk about what the early avocados were like? Because they're so different. We'll talk about Haas here in a second, but they're so different than the avocados that we're familiar with. When I lived in Pasadena, or actually specifically Altadena, I had a giant avocado tree in my backyard, which became a beautiful nesting ground for a bunch of parakeets who would wake me up every morning. And the avocados would fall off the tree. And it was one of those varieties that had incredibly thin skin and the incredibly large pit. So to get a bowl of guacamole out of those guys, it would have taken seven or eight of them to get a decent size amount. So can you talk a little bit about some of the early varieties? You can maybe mention the Forte variety if you would like.
Avocados are fascinating because they are extremely heterozygous. So, like a human being, you get a mom and a dad, and the son or daughter is going to be completely different person. They're going to inherit some of those characteristics of the father, some, but they might skip generations. It's going to be a totally different person. That's the same thing with an avocado. You put a seed in the ground, you are not going to get the same avocado tree that the seed came from. So the only way you can preserve a varietal again and again, just like with grapes, is by grafting. And so that weird heterozygous nature of avocados was fascinating to the early Californians because they loved the variety. And yes, sometimes a tree would grow up and it would have the worst characteristics of the mother or father plant, but sometimes it would be better. And once they learned how to asexually reproduce using grafting, then they could say, okay, this is a great one. Let's preserve this one. And because it has a smaller seed and it has, for example, more flesh to it, or it can hang on the tree for a longer period of time, or it doesn't get oxidized as quickly as the other avocado, or it's just better tasting. Because as we know, avocados have all sorts of different tastes. I had an old avocado called a Zutano, which is a Mexican type avocado, because there's three races of avocados. There's Guatemalan, Mexican, and West Indian. So scientists sometime in the 70s identified that there are three different types of avocados, but even the Spanish knew that there were these weird different types of avocados. West Indians are the kind of avocados in Florida. Sometimes they're called Florida avocados, and they tend to be giant. They tend to be thin-skinned, and they have much lower oil content. So instead of a 15, 16, 17, 18% oil content in a Hass, they have 8 or 9%, and they have a sweet flesh, very watery. But if that's all you know, and you're using it for dessert or smoothies, then it works. But Californians realized early on, hey, we can grow much better avocados than Florida. Florida can only grow these terrible West Indian, but we can grow Mexican and Guatemalan style avocados, and we can hybridize them. So they started doing all these breeding trials. And what became apparent early on in the industry, we're talking about 1900 to 1915, is all these nurserymen who are like part horticulturalists, but part hustlers. They were in places like Altadena. One of the most famous nurseries in California was called the West Indian Gardens. And it was founded by Frederick Popenoe and his son Wilson. And they became the most important people probably in that first 3 decades for avocados. And Altadena was the first one to say, hey, look, we can't have 200 different avocados, which they did by 1950. There were 200 varieties. We need to standardize our product. And so we are sending our employees, my son Wilson Popenoe and Carl Schmidt, we're going to send them to Mexico to find the best avocado because we don't think we have it here. We've got these weird ones with the big pits and the skin's too thin. They take 16 months to ripen. Let's get the best avocado. So they would send these fruit explorers down to Mexico. And so somebody came back in 1911, 1912, Carl Schmidt, who was sent by Wilson the Popenoes from West India Gardens in Altadena. And he came back with a bunch of different examples, and they started to breed them in their nurseries. And then in 1913, there was this horrible freeze. It killed all their samples, except for a little seedling that they had brought back that they had named Fuerte. A lot of people think they named it Fuerte because it survived the frost, but really it was named Fuerte because it was so prolific, so prodigious. It had so much more fruit than the other avocados around it. And it has sort of a lot of buds and stuff like that. So this pig farmer comes to pick up his trees, but they'd all been killed in the frost. So Popenoe says, why don't you take these? They're the only ones we have. We can't pay you back your money. Take these. And so this guy goes up from his home into Yorba Linda and plants them. And lo and behold, it bears more fruit than any other tree he'd ever had. And it tasted so much better. It had a medium-sized seed. And all of a sudden, people were demanding grafts from it. And the Popenoes had this hit on their hands. And so with the leadership of the new California Avocado Association, which became the Avocado Society, eventually California Avocado Society, they said, look, Fuerte should be our bellwether. It should be our standard bearer variety. And little by little, over about 10, 15 years, it became the variety in California. And it's what we'd call more of a Mexican type. It's thin-skinned. It has a very mild flavor, but interesting. And it bears and this doesn't have to do with Mexican or Guatemalan, but it bears fruit in winter and spring. So right now, as we speak in January here, it is, or rather late December, it's Fuerte season in California. So back until 1960, every avocado, or say 60% of the avocados you had, or 70%, would be Fuerte avocados. But another avocado was gaining on it, and it was a Guatemalan type. And we can talk about that because that avocado eventually took over the world, and it's called a Hass avocado or Haas avocado.
Yeah, one thing that really stuck out to me in your book that was interesting was this kind of strategic move to try and edge out Florida and Mexico in the avocado industry. Can you tell a little bit about that story and why
Yeah.
that was a strategic decision of California growers?
When California started, say in the late 1800s, and really 1915 was when the industry was starting to get going, two things happened. One, Wilson, President Wilson, was very into tariffs, which we're coming full circle, very into protectionist economic philosophy. And we found a way, I don't want to be too cynical about it. There was a weevil that would eat the seeds of avocados. And you wouldn't necessarily see them when they came in from Mexico. Not that there was any fruit coming from Mexico, but they knew this weevil existed in avocados in Mexico. And one way or the other, through lobbying by California, probably, they put a quarantine in 1911, but it kicked in 1915 or so, on all avocados imported from Mexico. Now, Mexico didn't really care because it consumed all its avocados and it didn't have an industry. It hadn't even begun to really commercialize its product. Mexicans ate a ton of avocados, 10 or 15 times as much as Californians, but they got them from their backyards. They were dooryard fruits, we call them, dooryard trees. And so they didn't care. So it allowed California to develop its industry without interference, without any competition from Mexico. Now, was that weevil a real problem? I don't know, but that quarantine existed for 83 years. And it wasn't until the year 2000, and we could talk about that later, but it wasn't until 2000 with NAFTA that Mexican avocados were finally allowed to come in. I think that quarantine was a bit of a protectionist act by the U.S. and by California in particular to protect California avocados. And it wasn't just avocados, it was all sorts of other things too. But Florida, by the late 1800s, it had a real industry going. And so when the founders of the California Avocado Society, people like Edwin Hart and Coit and the Poponos, when they got together, they said, look, we know we can grow better fruit than Florida. We know Florida's got bad fruit, but we're finding their fruit in LA and San Francisco. It's finding its way here. 90% of the fruit Florida produces in their 2,000 acres of groves are being exported. That could be a problem for us partly because our avocados are so much better. Their avocados are terrible. So people are going to have an avocado and say, oh, I guess avocados are terrible. And we're going to have to explain to them, no, you just ate the wrong kind of avocado. So one way or another, California eventually passed a law, and I say it's right around 1925, that put a minimum oil content for avocados. And lo and behold, that minimum oil content was about 8%, which is about as much oil as the typical Florida avocado could produce, max. And so the first shipments after that law was passed came into California. All the shipments were rejected, sent back to Florida. And really, there were no avocados from Florida that made its way successfully to California for the next 60 years, 50 years. So it was just a very interesting, and I never found any evidence at all of somebody in the California avocado industry writing a letter to their senator. But
I have no doubt there was some collusion there of some kind.
I think it's a little too convenient that the number one competitor, Florida, was effectively shut out of the California market, and California suddenly had this monopoly. And by the time Florida won its law in the Supreme Court, it was the 70s. And by then, California had a stranglehold on the avocado market in the United States. And Florida has never been a player since then. Mm-hmm. We did the same thing to Cuba, by the way. Although we never did impose protectionist policies against Cuba, but when Castro took over in the 50s, there was an embargo on everything. And so all those Cuban avocados that were coming in, and there were millions, dried up as well. And again, yay for California, we got a monopoly again.
Fantastic. This past weekend, I went to a really fun event that's in Exeter, California. It's in the foothills, and it's a citrus festival where they have what seemed like almost 200 varieties of tangerines, tangors, grapefruit, lemons, everything you can think of. And it was really fun to go around and try all these different varieties that I'd never heard of, which is a way for me to ask you this question. What do you think consumers lost when the commercialization era started? We're not going to go into a supermarket and find a bunch of varieties of avocado. Yeah. So do you think we lost anything as consumers?
I certainly do. And it's funny, there are different segments of the industry. There are the handlers, also known as the distributors of the avocados. And then there are the growers. And then there are some scholars and aficionados. The scholars, the aficionados, and the growers, they love variety. But the handlers and the marketing people, the corporate end of things, they want, just like every industry, they wanted standardization of fruit because it's easier to market and different avocados ripen differently. They taste different. They wanted everybody to have the same experience. Think of our banana. The same thing happened to the banana industry. And so the avocado industry looked to the oranges early on. And although you saw all these varieties, the orange industry very early on in California, which was the first big agricultural industry, I'd say, it had a whole sorts of varieties. But early on, they said, okay, we're only going to have one or two. And sure enough, Navel and Valencia, those are the oranges you still see in the market. There's some at the margins, but that's 95%. The reason why the industry early on wanted at least four or five or six varieties is because varieties ripen at different times during the year. And so we thought, as Californians early on, we're talking about the 40s and 50s and into the 60s, we want to provide the United States with avocados year round. How do we do that? You have to have at least four or five or six different varieties. Plus, they're wonderful. The one avocado is higher in oil, but this one has a richer taste. This one is more densely compact, but this one is wonderful in Mexican food, or it makes a great guacamole. So let's have more variety. And unfortunately, for everyone, I think we lost that for the sake of, I don't want to say money, but yeah, for the sake of ease of scalability. If we went from doing at our peak in California, 400 or 500 million pounds of avocados a year, that was probably in the late 80s or 90s. Now we have 3 billion pounds of avocados. California was never going to be able to scale up with its varieties, no matter how hard it tried, with that level of doing five different varieties. We just can't do it. So I guess what I'm trying to say is it is a shame, but you can still find in California at smaller markets, at farmers markets, you'll find Fuerte right now. You'll find Reed in season. You'll find Lamb Hass, which is similar to Lamb, but bigger, and new avocados like the Gem avocado. And I have a wonderful market. If you've been down to San Diego, you know it, but it's a little fruit stand called the Mom and Pop, literally Mom and Pop fruit stand off of I-76 and the 15 right there at that junction in Fallbrook. And they'll have the California dream. They'll have different avocados throughout the year. And so if you go there in April, if you go there in July, if you go there in February, you're always going to get a different type of avocado. And I think that is a wonderful experience. I wish everybody could have it, but I don't think it's ever going to happen now.
Okay. For our last section, I'm going to ask you some rapid fire avocado questions. We'll go through a bunch of them. We'll start with, what was the funniest or strangest marketing ad for avocados that you found in your research?
There were quite a few. And it was like Mad Men. Imagine Mad Men applied to avocados. There were 46 sales offices across the United States, and they were trying anything. I think the funniest one might be, the one that comes to mind is when they found Angie Dickens, was this famous actress who was in Policewoman and all these TV shows basically in the 60s and 70s. And the marketing director for what became the California Avocado Commission met her at a party, and he said, I work for this avocado commission. And she goes, I love avocados. He said, we're getting attacked right and left by the Heart Association and other people, diet groups, because avocados are fat. They have this high oil, but it's a good fat. It's good for your heart. It lowers your cholesterol. It's not like lard. And she goes, I'll do an ad for you to help you with that. And so they came up with this idea of having, this could never work today, probably. They had this beautiful woman, Angie Dickinson, in a white Imagine Olivia Newton-John like a bathing suit or workout suit, and she's reclined on the floor and she's holding a slice of avocado on a fork, and she's talking about all the amazing health benefits of an avocado, how dense nutrient they are, and the best fats, and the high oil, and fairly low calorie for what they are, and how satiating they are, etc. And then at the end, she says, "Would this body lie to you?" And that became one of the most famous ads of the late 70s and early 80s. And it didn't end the war on fat against avocados, but it struck a mortal blow on the war of fat, and it shifted the conversation, and it made avocado into a sexy fruit, which the avocado producers had always wanted it to be. They'd always used models to sell avocados. There's something about avocados and sex, for lack of a better word, that are somewhat consonant. They're somewhat compatible. And so they would always use that. There were all sorts of ads used in trade magazines with beautiful women in a hammock, naked practically, and with an avocado on the side. There were sunglass commercials, there were wine commercials. They're not allowed to do that anymore. You're not allowed to have these tie-in ads for the most part. But back in the day, the avocado people said, "You know what? We need to put our avocado with all sorts of other products, and it saves us money, saves them money, and we get to benefit." You know, this symbiotic relationship. So avocados were with chips and wine and motor oil and sunglasses and bathing suits. And then they caught on with the facial creams. People in the 70s discovered avocados were good for your face. And so they would have beauty pamphlets by the avocado displays in supermarkets about how to use avocados at home for your facial.
I will admit that my wife has put an avocado mask on me before, so I participated in
And your
this
face looks
movement.
beautiful, by the
Oh,
way. So
thank you.
no wonder, no wonder.
If you could only eat one avocado variety for the rest of your life, which one would you choose?
The Hass avocado has become a powerhouse, not just because it's got thick skin and it can ship well and it can be produced all year round in Mexico, but also because it is an excellent avocado with high oil. But if I had to choose one, I would choose, I think, the new Gem avocado. That was produced in the late 70s in a series of breeding trials by Bob Berg up in Camarillo, California. And it's like the best of both worlds. It's slightly larger than a Hass. It has super creamy fruit. It's beautiful to look at. It's got thinner skin than Hass, but at the same time, you can peel that skin, unlike a Fuerte, which you can't peel it. It's like crepe paper. And so it's just very high in oil. So Gem, which is GEM, it's named after its co-inventor, Greg E. Martin. I'm sorry, Gray E. Martin, who is still produce fruit, I guess, horticulturalist in Valley Center, California. And he was the one who named it Gem, partly because it looks like it has a galaxy of stars on the outside of the peel. It's a beautiful looking fruit. So Gem.
Okay.
But if I had to choose again, I would choose Reed. I like Reed avocados too.
I love that at the end of your chapters you include recipes. If you would hope that readers would make one recipe from the book, if you had to choose, which one would you want them to make?
Wow, they're gonna make guacamole whether I tell them to or
Right.
not.
That kind of goes without saying, right?
But notwithstanding the guacamole, I would say, not to be stereotypical here, but I didn't grow up eating avocado toast. But avocado toast, there is something magical about it. And even though millennials, like you probably,
Yep.
think invented avocado toast,
Oh, we did. We did. You know, we did.
it's a dish that has been around since the 1500s, when the Spanish brought flour and those Aztecs and stopped putting avocado on their tortillas and said, "Hey, it's pretty good on toast too." So it's those recipes for avocado toast have been around in print since the early 1900s. But what I do is in my recipe in the book is I scoop out the avocado carefully. I cut it in very thin slices. I spread it out like you would a deck of cards. And then I get a great thin slice of sourdough bread, toast it, put olive oil on there, lift up my avocado slices, put them on the toast, put a little avocado, a little oil on there, little olive oil, some salt, maybe some red pepper flakes. It is about the best thing you will ever eat in your life. The texturally, in terms of your senses and taste, and you can eat a half an avocado on a piece of sourdough bread, and I promise you, you will not be hungry until 1 p.m. if you eat it at 8. It is so satiating and wonderful. So you will eat again, but you don't have to. So avocado toast.
Perfect. Perfect. Do you have any special tips on making your own guacamole? Is there anything through your research that you discovered, any tips or strategies to improve it?
Yeah, everybody has their own style. And when I gave my recipe in there, everybody came up with 18 different ideas. I think simpler is better. And so I use molcajete, one of those grinding bowls that you see they sell in Mexico or whatever. They sell it here too. And I'll grind in some salt and a couple cloves of garlic. And I think that's a really nice trick. And you smash it in with the salt. And then you slice about a half an onion, very thinly sliced. It can be a white onion or it can be a red onion. And then you combine it with your avocado. And it's very simple. You could put some cilantro in there. I think cilantro adds a lot. You have to be very careful not to overwhelm. The avocado can get very overwhelmed quickly with too many ingredients, especially tomatoes. I've found instantly add water to guacamole, and water is the great enemy of guacamole. So I would do that. And then I do personally like citrus. A lot of people say citrus overwhelms that taste, but I think a little judicious use at the end, once you've combined the avocado with those other ingredients, the garlic, the ground garlic, and then smashed garlic, and then the onions, and you combine them together. You don't want to overmix. That is the key to a great guacamole. You never put it in the blender. You never add any sour cream or anything like that. You don't overmix. You want to have those nice chunks in there. And people who think they're afraid of avocados, they only eat they only eat guacamole, and they want to make sure there's no chunks. They're going to discover when they have those nice little chunks of unblended avocado, they're going to realize, wow, what have I been missing this my whole life? So don't overmix. Onions, a little bit of garlic, a little bit of salt, and maybe a squeeze of lemon, maybe a little cilantro on top. That's the perfect guacamole for me.
I ask every guest this: how has the research and writing the book about the history of avocados in California, how has that changed your perspective on the history of California more generally?
Wow. Yeah, I tell people that the history of the avocado is the history of California. The first avocados come in about mid-1800s, right when California becomes a state. They really grow in LA. The first groves tended to be in Santa Barbara, but also in Los Angeles and San Marino, and downtown still has 120-year-old avocado trees, if you know where to look for them, and so does Huntington. So what changed, I guess my perspective changed in that I realized the industry of Californians, the enthusiasm, the optimism of those early Californians was infectious. And I know it wasn't just with avocados, but avocados were a great case study to show that when Californians are passionate about something, they're going to make the whole world passionate about it. And that's exactly what happened with avocados. Californians loved it so much that they sent essentially apostles, evangelists, in the form of scholars and growers all over the world, including back to Mexico, to teach them how to make their own industries because they believed so much in this product. And so California showed me the power it has to shape the world, in this case, for the good, because now California is maybe the 15th largest avocado producer in the world. But we were the only one. really. We're the only industry for almost 75 years. And it was only through Californians' work, creativity, and passion that these other countries learned to look at the avocado and say, hey, maybe this is something we might like. Maybe this is something we should get into. So that's why I always say California invented the avocado. So it showed me the ingenuity and creativity of Californians.
Okay. We always close in the same place, which is with book recommendations, either on these topics or just books that are important to you, California related. What would you recommend to listeners?
I do love to read history in California in general, but the one that comes off to my mind are the Charles Bukowski. Charles Bukowski is a poet from LA, very much an LA poem. I was down in LA by a club called The Mint, watching my son, who's a aspiring rock musician, and he was playing at a club called The Mint. And in a mural on The Mint is a beautiful mural of Charles Bukowski. And he talks about the seedy side, I guess, of California. And he's very much a California poet. He's really an LA poet. And he's identified with the beat poets like Kerouac or Ginsberg, but he didn't care about any of that stuff. And so I've been reading, I'm a poet as well, and I teach poetry. So I guess, I don't know why, but Charles Bukowski's writing leaps to mind as a neat segue into a different part of California that you're probably not too familiar with. So yeah, I'd recommend his work.
Yeah, I'm looking at a bookshelf right behind my screen here, and I see Ham on Rye just staring at me over there. So very much so, I'm on the same page. Rob, to close, what are you working on next?
Gosh, right now I am doing a book on a winery out here in Temecula called Robert Renzoni Vineyards and Winery. And it's just a winery. And he saw my book on Temecula Valley wineries, and I'd known Robert for some time. And he said, I would like to create a coffee table book to honor my parents who are in their mid-80s and help me start this winery. And I would like it to be about the seasons. And I would like it to be this big 150-page, beautiful coffee table book that I would just sell inside the winery. And I said, well, okay, I can do that. It's not gonna be my book. It'll be your book, but I will do it. So I'm working on that. And then I've been tempted by the same publisher to write a book on California cheese. The history of California cheese is fascinating, and the artisanal cheese movement is a very special thing if you're familiar with it. It's mostly a Northern California phenomenon in Sonoma and places north of San Francisco. And I'm considering that because it combines my two loves of agriculture and food and travel in California. So I'm still thinking about that. But right now I'm in between projects and I'm trying to get as many people to read about California avocados as possible right now. That's my job.
I really enjoyed reading the book. And I think that writing about gastronomy sounds like the most fun thing of any kind of writing task. Yeah. Again, the book is called California Avocados, A Delicious History. Rob, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Thank you so much, Jordan. I really appreciate it, man. Take care.
Thanks for listening, everyone. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider supporting us by either giving us a rating and review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/historyofcalifornia. We'll see you next time. ¶¶